Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today on the program, we have two reports related to workers from Southeast Asia. Our first story is about a pay increase for some workers in Cambodia. Jill Robbins has the report.
The minimum wage for Cambodia's garment sector will rise to $140 a month. The new rate is almost 10% more than the current pay rate. Business owners wanted a lower increase. Unions asked for $160 a month. The new pay rate will apply to 700,000 workers in January 2016. The clothing, textile, and apparel industry exports more than any other economic sector in Cambodia. Garment workers now earn $128 a month. The government, manufacturers, and unions talked for weeks before the agreement. The Garment Manufacturers Association in Cambodia, or GMAC, represents 600 factories that export garments and shoes. Ken Liu is the Secretary General of GMAC. He says the association must accept the government's decision. The GMAC wanted a lower pay rate. They want buyers to pay more for the goods sold from Cambodia. The manufacturers are afraid investors will go to other countries.
We have to abide by the decision of the government. However, if the buyers continue to pay lip service or continue to be hypocritical about actually raising their prices that they are paying to the factories here, then we will see more factory closures. We will see less new factories or new investors coming to Cambodia. And this is a fact.
News media report that most unions, including those that agree with the government, have approved the new deal. At least two unions, however, have not agreed. Ot Torn heads one of those unions, the Cambodian Labor Confederation. It says that it has about 70,000 members. Mr. Torn says his union will continue to ask for $160. In the coming weeks, the union will listen to the opinions of its members. Then union leaders will make a decision on whether or not to strike or stop working. The government made the final decision to increase the minimum wage. After agreeing on $135, Cambodia's Prime Minister, Hun Sen, ordered another $5 a month to be added to that, bringing the total to $140. The increase made by the Prime Minister was not a surprise. He did the same thing last year. His action shows the importance of the minimum wage issue in Cambodian politics. The ruling party must keep two groups happy, voters and investors. The garment sector workers are a large part of the 10 million voters in Cambodia. Hun Sen's party came close to losing the 2013 general election. The next general election is scheduled for 2018. The party knows it must improve its image among garment workers. Most of the workers are young women whose wages support families living in rural areas. They traditionally support the opposition party. The garment manufacturing industry is crucial to Cambodia's economy. It is the largest employer and the main source of money from outside the country. Most exports are to the United States and the European Union. Workers in Cambodia make products for many well-known Western brands, such as H&M, Adidas, Gap, and Armani. The image of the garment industry has suffered in recent years because of labor arguments and the bad treatment of independent unions. The lowest point was in early 2014, when Cambodian authorities shot dead at least 5 workers during fighting over the minimum wage and working conditions. I'm Jill Robbins.
You are listening to As It Is from VOA, Learning English. Vietnamese workers accuse Chinese workers at a building company in Algeria of attacking them when they refused to work because of disputes. Christopher Jones Cruz has more.
Vietnamese workers in Algeria say supervisors and co-workers from China beat them and refused them food. The alleged attacks happened last month. They became known last week after the workers asked the Vietnamese government for help. Vietnamese have been writing angry messages online about the alleged attacks. Many Vietnamese are unhappy with China because of border and South China Sea disputes. Pictures on social media show the injuries 2 of the workers say they suffered during the attack. Vietnamese media report the Chinese company they were working for is called Dongyi Jiangsu Company Limited. VOA was not successful in its efforts to speak to representatives of the company. Dao Nuc Mung is one of 2 workers who say they suffered severe injuries. He said he was attacked by a group of his Chinese co-workers. He says they were told by their supervisors to attack the Vietnamese workers. He says the Chinese workers forced him and his co-workers into their rooms, then took him to the office and beat him with canes. He says he and a co-worker suffered broken bones. Mr. Kung said he wants to return to his family in Vietnam. He says they are worried about his health. He says he and his co-workers were denied food during the time they were detained and beaten. Nguyen Van Dung is an official at Vietnam's embassy in Algiers. He confirmed the attack in an interview with VOA. He says the embassy is trying to return the workers to Vietnam. He says the Vietnamese government asked the Chinese embassy in Algiers for help to stop the company from harming Vietnamese workers. But he says they did not receive an answer from the Chinese. He says sources told them Chinese officials ordered representatives of the company to come to the embassy. He says Vietnamese officials took the workers to the hospital to be examined. He says the results of the exams will be used as evidence against the company. Vietnam will ask the company to pay the workers. VOA asked the Chinese embassy in Algiers for information about the reported attacks, but has not received an answer. Mr. Zung said more than 2,000 Vietnamese are working in Algeria. That is among the highest number of Vietnamese workers of any country. The Vietnamese government says more than 500,000 Vietnamese are working in more than 40 countries and territories throughout the world. Workers dispute contracts and promised income. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
If you learned about grammar in school, you were probably taught to think about correct and incorrect ways of using a language. The traditional way of teaching grammar in school is called prescriptive grammar. Grammar is seen as a set of rules to follow. Those who do not follow the rules are looked down upon as being careless or poorly educated. In America, the style of grammar used in academic, government, and professional situations is called Standard American English. There is no official government agency in the United States that makes rules for the English language. Teachers usually rely on tradition and popular style guides to decide what proper grammar is. Descriptive grammar takes a different approach. Descriptive grammarians observe and analyze language as it is used in different communities. They look for rules and patterns that people follow. In descriptive grammar, there is no correct or incorrect way of using grammar. For example, a prescriptive grammarian might say, "Don't use a double negative because it is illogical." A descriptive grammarian might say, "Some communities use double negatives and some do not." Dr. Richard Epstein is a linguist at Rutgers University in Camden, New Jersey. Dr. Epstein says that most people do not understand the social and political processes behind grammar rules.
Nobody knows why we should not use ain't, or why we should not use double negatives, because the teachers teach these things as if they were just simply rules that came down from some higher power, authority, maybe God, and there's no rhyme or reason taught for what the reason is for the existence of these rules. So it seems quite boring and totally arbitrary.
Dr. Epstein says grammar rules have nothing to do with logic. Instead, they are based on social fashions, politics, and power. He gives the example of the double negative. As we mentioned on an episode of Everyday Grammar, certain types of double negative words are not allowed in standard American English. For example, "I don't know nothing." The two words "don't" and "nothing" are both negative. Most Americans were taught that double negatives are illogical. In math, two negatives equal a positive. But is this true in language? Does "I don't know nothing" mean "I know something"? Of course not. It just makes a stronger negative. The rule against the double negative does not come from math. It comes from Robert Loth, the Bishop of London. Robert Loth's book, A Short Introduction to English Grammar, first published in 1762, prohibited the double negative. Dr. Epstein says that random grammar rules were a way for the upper classes of London to protect themselves from a rising middle class. Nobody will go to jail for ignoring grammar rules, but they will have difficulty getting into the best schools and finding good jobs. I'm Adam Brock.
Thank you. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. As we said last week, James Buchanan of Pennsylvania won the presidential election of 1856. He defeated John Fremont, the candidate of the newly created Republican Party, which opposed slavery. Buchanan, a Democrat, had often supported the South in the dispute over slavery. Most of the new president's closest friends were Southerners. He wrote that the North was too aggressive toward the South and should stop interfering in the slave states. Buchanan said the South had good reason to leave the Union if abolitionists continued their attacks against slavery. This week on our series, Jack Moyles and Stan Busby tell more about James Buchanan, and they discuss his influence in the Supreme Court ruling in the case of a slave from Missouri named Dred Scott.
As the new president, Buchanan believed he could solve the slave question by keeping the abolitionists quiet. Success would mean the end of the anti-slavery Republican Party. In choosing his cabinet, Buchanan wanted men who shared the same ideas and interests. President Pierce had tried to unite the different groups in the party by giving each a representative in his cabinet. This had not worked. It had driven the different party groups farther apart. Buchanan had served in President Polk's cabinet. He remembered how well its members worked together. He said it was the unity of this cabinet that made Polk's administration so successful.
Buchanan gave the job of Secretary of State to Lewis Cass of Michigan. Cass was 75 years old. His mind had lost its sharpness. This did not worry Buchanan, because he had planned to be his own foreign minister. The job of Treasury Secretary went to Howell Cobb, a Southern moderate from Georgia. Southerners also were named as Secretary of War, Interior Secretary, and Postmaster General. Isaac Tousey of Connecticut was given the job of Navy Secretary. Tousey was a Northerner, but he supported many policies of the South. Another Northerner, Jeremiah Black of Pennsylvania, became Attorney General. In forming his cabinet, Buchanan did not ask for advice from Senator Douglas of Illinois. Douglas was the party's leader in the Senate and the most powerful Democrat in the Northwest. Douglas believed that the Northwest should have two representatives in the cabinet. He said Cass could be one of them. But Douglas wanted one of his own supporters to be the other. Buchanan refused what Douglas wanted, and he gave the administration's support to a political enemy of Douglas.
James Buchanan was sworn in as president on March 4th, 1857. In his inaugural speech, the new president denounced the long dispute over slavery. He said he hoped it would end soon. Buchanan said the dispute could be settled easily by doing two things: by ending interference with slavery in states where it was legal, and by letting the people of a territory decide if they wanted slavery. Buchanan said he expected the Supreme Court to rule soon on the right of the people of a territory to decide this. He said he was sure that all good citizens, North and South, would accept the High Court's ruling.
At the time he said this, Buchanan already knew what the court's decision would be. He had even used his influence to help one member of the court to decide. The decision was made in the case of Dred Scott, a Negro slave. Scott was sold in Missouri to an army doctor who took him to Illinois and then went into the Wisconsin Territory. Scott lived in these two places for almost 4 years before he was returned to Missouri. Scott asked a court in Missouri to give him his freedom. He claimed that living in Illinois and Wisconsin, where slavery was illegal, had made him a free man.
The court agreed with Scott and gave him his freedom. But the decision was appealed, and the Supreme Court of Missouri ruled against him. Scott then took his case to a federal court. Finally, he asked the United States Supreme Court to decide if he was a slave or a free man. The Supreme Court took up the case in December 1856. The judges studied it carefully, because it raised serious constitutional questions. Scott claimed he was free because he had lived in free territory. It was free because Congress, in the Missouri Compromise of 1820, made slavery illegal in that area. Scott's owner raised the question, did Congress have the constitutional power to close a territory to slavery? Was the Missouri Compromise legal?
At first, most of the 9 Supreme Court judges had planned to give a decision without answering this question. They did not want to involve the court in this bitter dispute. The majority decided that a Negro was not a citizen. Therefore, they said, Dred Scott had no right to ask the court to hear his case. In this way, the case could be settled without deciding on the power of Congress to act on slavery in the territories. But 2 of the 9 Supreme Court judges opposed this ruling. Both were from the North. They had said they would write a minority decision. They said their decision would include a statement that Congress did have power over slavery in the territories.
Since 2 members of the court had planned to offer views on this question, the other 7 decided the majority also should do so. Of the 7, 5 were from the South. They did not believe Congress had any power over territorial slavery. The remaining 2 judges, both from the North, did not want to make what they felt would be a political decision. 1 Southern member of the Supreme Court was James Catron, a good friend of James Buchanan. Buchanan had written to him, asking when the court would act on the Dred Scott case.
Catron had answered that the court would rule soon. Then he asked for Buchanan's help in getting one of the northern members of the court to vote with the 5 from the South. He told the president that the country would more easily accept the court's ruling if one of the northern judges gave his support. Catron proposed that Buchanan write to Justice Robert Greer of Pennsylvania. So Buchanan wrote to Greer. He told him that a strong decision in the Dred Scott case might do much to bring peace to the country. Greer agreed. He said he would vote with the 5 Southerners. They would rule that the Constitution did not give Congress power over slavery in the territories. All this had happened in the few weeks before Buchanan became president.
The Supreme Court finally announced its decision just 2 days after Buchanan moved into the White House. Chief Justice Roger Taney read the decision in the small courtroom in the Capitol building. The room was crowded with congressmen, senators, government officials, and newspapermen. Chief Justice Taney began reading the decision at 11 o'clock. He read for more than 2.5 hours. He said the High Court rejected Scott's claim of freedom for 3 reasons. First, Scott was not a citizen. Taney said the Constitution gave the right of citizenship only to members of the white race. Because he was not a citizen, he had no right to ask the court to hear his case. Secondly, Taney said Scott was ruled by the laws of Missouri, the state in which he lived. Missouri laws did not give freedom to slaves who lived temporarily in free territory. Therefore, said Taney, Scott was still a slave.
Then the Chief Justice took up the question of the free territory in which Scott had lived. It had become free territory under the Missouri Compromise. This was the law that Congress passed in 1820. This law kept slavery out of the northern part of the territory, which the United States bought from France. Justice Taney said Congress did not have the constitutional power to pass such a law. He said when new territory was won, it belonged to all citizens. He said Congress had the right to govern such territory until it became a state. But, he said, Congress did not have power to close new territory to any American citizen. He said the citizen from Georgia had as much right to settle in this territory with his slaves as a citizen of Maine with his horse. Taney said there was no word in the Constitution that gave Congress greater power over slave property than over any other kind of property. The only such power Congress held was the power to guard and protect the rights of the property owner. To close territory to slaves, Taney said, violated the constitutional rights of slaveholding citizens. Therefore, the Missouri Compromise was unconstitutional. Congress did not have power to act on slavery in the territories.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Jack Moyles and Stan Busby. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs can be found, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. And you can follow our series on Twitter at twitter.com/VOA Learn English, spelled as one word. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English. Thank you.